Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. 5 years ago this month, on February 14th, 2008, five people were killed and 21 injured in a mass shooting on the campus of Northern Illinois University. The shooter then took his own life. That would, of course, be enough to warrant today's program examining the intersection of mental health and gun violence. But, of course, what happened at NIU has been but one of a spate of mass shootings in recent years, including deadly incidents last summer in an Aurora, Colorado movie theater, and then again in December at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. Today on the program, as part of this week's After Newtown special coverage on public media, we are going to look at the intersection of mental health and gun violence. In a few minutes, we will discuss mental health needs on college campuses and throughout the region with Tom Pollack from Crosspoint Human Services in Danville, educational psychology professor Dorothy Espelage, and Mary Kay Mace, whose only daughter was killed in the shooting on the NIU campus 5 years ago. But first, in the wake of these recent shootings, there has been, of course, lots of debate and hand-wringing over our nation's gun laws. What little gun rights supporters and gun control advocates do seem to agree on is the fact that there may be some sort of intersection between acts of gun violence and mental health, and reform of mental health services should be a part of the conversation. More than a year ago, a group of Midwest journalism professors and students reported on the challenges that university counseling centers face in seeking to provide such mental health services. Today, health professionals say the situation is not much improved. The Focus team's Pam Dempsey of CU Citizen Access and the Investigative Journalism Education Consortium has a report.
On a recent Thursday morning inside the Champaign County Sheriff's Office, Sheriff Dan Walsh prepares for a meeting. His office, located across from the courthouse in downtown Urbana, sits on top of one of the two county jails. Walsh says that at any given time, between 20% and 50% of the jail's inmates suffer from some kind of mental illness.
Our numbers have, if anything, increased because the bed space with the state has decreased.
At any one time, there are 5 to 7 inmates on a waiting list for a bed in a mental health facility, Walsh says.
We are not designed, nor is a jail a good place to engage in long-term mental health treatment. It's just not good.
Walsh noted the growing mental health problems among the inmates in a letter he wrote this year to state lawmakers arguing against gun reform. Semi-assault weapons have not been a problem in Champaign County or Central Illinois, Walsh says.
On the other hand, mentally ill folks, both the problems they have and then the problems they cause, that is, to me, a significant problem in Champaign County and in Central Illinois.
Dan Jones is president of the Association for University and College Counseling Center Directors. He says over the past 2 decades, mental health services across the country have been dismantled.
I think increased mental health centers, services on campuses as well as in the community would help intercept and reroute some of these violent paths.
But Jones cautions against the prediction of violence. People who suffer from mental illness tend to be the victims rather than the criminals, Jones says.
So I think that's something that gets lost in the discussion. And there's no test that you could give somebody that will predict violence for people that come into university counseling centers.
Jones says typically college counseling centers are called on to do more when there are cases like the shooting in Colorado last year, where a graduate student allegedly killed 12 people and wounded nearly 60 in a movie theater in Aurora. But college counseling centers are struggling to keep up with the demand for services as more and more students seek help. Carla McCowan is the director for the Mental Health Center at the University of Illinois in Urbana. She says the increased demand for services over the past few years have prompted staff to revisit the process. Students in crisis are seen the same day, but follow-up appointments can take up to a few weeks.
So we're really talking about, okay, what's the tipping point? But at the same time, you open your gates even wider, you know, kind of on the front end, but how do you continue to respond to, you know, kind of to hold that many students? The question is of how are we going to develop a system that really kind of responds? What's the balance?
And access to guns should be looked at too, Jones says, as reducing a person's access to the means of suicide helps prevent suicide.
Well, I think if guns are allowed on campus, it's hard to know what impact that would have on violence, like school shootings. But I'm fairly confident that suicide rates would increase.
Be it in school or in jail, one thing is clear. The need for mental health services continues to grow. For Illinois Public Media, I'm Pam Dempsey.
To discuss the intersection of gun violence and mental health, we are joined this morning by three guests. Dorothy Espelage is a professor of educational psychology at the University of Illinois. She studies adolescent aggressive behavior. You might recall she joined us last fall to discuss issues related to bullying. Dorothy Espelage, welcome back to Focus.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Glad to have you with us. Tom Pollack is Executive Director of Crosspoint Human Services in Danville. Crosspoint provides mental health and recovery services, psychiatric care, and youth crisis services, among other services, for East Central Illinois. Tom Pollack, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And Mary Kay Mace is the mother of Ryan Mace, one of the five people killed 5 years ago this month at Northern Illinois University. Mary Kay Mace, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
And as always, we welcome you to our conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or comment on Facebook or Twitter. You can find us on either site at Focus 580. Mary Kay Mace, I'd like to start with you, and if it's all right with you, I'd like to begin by asking you to tell us a little bit about your daughter, Ryan. What was she like? What were her interests?
Well, she was a beautiful girl, very, very bright, funny, engaging, easy to talk to. She was hardworking, civic-minded, responsible, a good student, and she was studying psychology to become a counselor to help people with their problems.
And that was what brought her to Northern Illinois University?
Yes.
How did you learn about the shooting on February 14th?
I was at work, and my boss's wife called and said, without preamble, you know, as soon as I answered the phone, there's been a shooting at NIU.
Oh,
and at
goodness.
That time, I didn't worry right away. I thought, well, you know, odds are Ryan's not even on campus. But then, you know, as I tried to get a hold of her more and more frantically each time, my husband and I decided to get in the car and go there.
And then when did you ultimately learn Ryan had been among those who had been shot?
It was after midnight, actually. There was a lot of back and forth trying to get her identified because they had one unidentified victim that had a tattoo, and my husband and I were unaware that she had a tattoo, so we kept saying, no, no, no.
Wow. I just have to say, I cannot imagine what that must have been like or what it continues to be like for you, and I am so sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
What has been the toughest part of life without your daughter in the 5 years since?
Oh, I just miss her so much. Every day I miss her. I want to be able to talk to her or see her. So that is the toughest part.
What in the 5 years since have you hoped would come out of such an awful shooting?
I hope that there would be more comprehensive gun safety laws, particularly with the background check system. I have found out that there are millions of records missing from the database of people who are supposed to be prohibited purchasers. These are not just mentally ill people, but convicted felons, domestic abuse offenders, people who are discharged from the military. It's a dishonorable discharge. So there are several different categories of prohibited purchasers, but if their records aren't in the database, they don't get red flagged for a background check, and they are able to buy guns legally, as was the NIU gunman.
I'm also curious what your reaction was to the recent mass shootings in Colorado and then in Newtown back in December.
I was just sick. I was heartsick and heartbroken, particularly Newtown. The day I found out about how many of those victims were just little kids, I shook all day. I shook all day.
Let me bring in at this point Tom Pollack and Dorothy Espelage. Tom, what sort of mental health services exist in East Central Illinois?
Well, there are two main community mental health centers, Community Elements in Champaign and Crosspoint Human Services in Vermilion County. We provide comprehensive services to the entire community, all incomes and all ages.
And then, Dorothy Espelage, what sorts of mental health counseling services are available at the University of Illinois?
Yeah, as you heard from the director at the Counseling Center, there's the Counseling Center that students can go to. There's also McKinley Student Health. But as they noted, you can be seen right away if it's a crisis for long-term kind of care that some folks prone to violence may need. There's limited availability.
Is there a need for expansion of these services, either Dorothy on campus or Tom in the community at large? Dorothy?
I think on campus, I mean, as they've said in the programming, mental health has been cut from K through 12, K through 16. And so given that there's weeks that folks have to wait to get an appointment beyond, unless they're in crisis, creates a situation where, yes, there's an extreme need.
Tom, is it similar outside of campus environments?
Absolutely. We try to provide immediate access for all services, but we'll either have waiting lists or we'll have to redirect people to other resources.
What would you like to see that's not available? Is it just need more people to address it, or what's missing?
Well, it would be nice to have more professionals available. The issue is, will the people in the community who have the needs actually recognize that they have it and then seek out the services that are available?
And then, Dorothy, among the things that are considered or active on campus, there's something called behavioral intervention teams. Can you tell us about those and how they work?
I'm not as familiar with those, but I know that these are teams that identify kids that are at risk for harming themselves or others. And then there's some type of monitoring, and those teams are a comprehensive team, but I can't speak directly to how they're functioning now, currently.
It seems like everyone acknowledges this sort of, and maybe this is an inappropriate inference, but that there is this inference that the perpetrators of these mass shootings, like the ones at NIU, at Virginia Tech, Nickel Mines, Aurora, Newtown, that they're all in some way mentally ill. How else to explain committing such violence on such a scale and so randomly? Are we doing enough to truly carefully examine gun violence from a mental health perspective, Dorothy?
Yeah, so I think many of the listeners may not be aware, but there's been a congressional ban on actually conducting gun violence research for the last 16 years. And I'm one of those PIs where if I wanted to inquire about a child's access to guns in their homes, I would not be allowed to ask those questions if I was funded by the Centers for Disease Control or National Institutes of Health. So we need to recognize that we haven't been allowed as researchers to uncover what are those risk and protective factors associated with gun violence. As a researcher, I take a very comprehensive approach to this. I think that as much as we need to have services on college campuses, this type of prevention work of preventing violence needs to start in preschool. And it could be, I mean, this is just a conjecture on my part, but I am in schools where in elementary school and middle school, there's also a lack of attention to mental health and social-emotional learning. So our counselors and social workers are really scrambling to address those needs. And if they go unaddressed, then we're sending kids to university that have serious mental health issues.
Why is it that there are these limits on the kinds of questions you can ask in the research that you do?
Because the Congress has banned this. NRA has decided that they don't want to have that information. Do you want to know how many kids have access to guns in their homes? And so, yeah, it's an extreme form of censorship and one that the average American is unaware of. And that congressional ban has not been lifted. I spent a couple days in D.C. 2 weeks ago trying to get our representatives in the state of Illinois to sign on to a bill that would lift the ban.
And any success?
Yes, we're making headway. We had several of our representatives in Illinois have signed on to the bill.
Any of them, I'm just curious if any of them are in downstate Illinois and within East Central Illinois?
We're still working on the representatives in Central Illinois who have, they have some challenges. They have a lot of constituents who are NRA members.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we are discussing the intersection between gun violence and mental health on today's program. Our guests, Tom Pollack, Executive Director of Crosspoint Human Services in Danville, Dorothy Espelage, Professor of Educational Psychology at the University of Illinois, and Mary Kay Mace, whose only daughter was killed in the shooting on the campus at Northern Illinois University 5 years ago. We welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or post your questions or comments on Facebook or Twitter. We are on both sites at Focus 580. Mary Kay Mace, you testified yesterday before the Illinois House Judiciary Committee about concealed weapons. What did they ask you and what did you tell them?
They didn't really ask me much, but what I told them was that I wanted for any legislation that they write to have as part of it shoring up the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, the database that we use to identify prohibited purchasers that, as I said before, is missing so many records, particularly in Illinois. There was a FOID card audit. The Auditor General found that there were 101,000 records of mentally ill people that went unreported from private nursing homes and hospitals. They also found that only three counties out of 102 counties in Illinois regularly made reportings of those adjudicated as mentally ill to the background check system, and also only 80 out of 130,000 licensed clinical mental health professionals make any reporting of those they deem to be a danger to themselves or others to the Department of Human Services, which is in turn supposed to make those records available for inclusion on the database. And so, you know, I just wanted them to be aware of all the dangerous omissions in the database before they start handing out permits to people to carry loaded weapons in public.
Tom, as I said earlier, there is a natural assumption that anyone who conducts a mass shooting is mentally ill. That doesn't, however, mean all mentally ill people are violent, nor does it mean someone who is not mentally ill is not capable of violence. Does that make it a more complicated process to try and understand where mental health and gun violence does intersect?
Yes, it makes it very complicated. I think one of the issues that I struggle with after having been in the business for over 40 years is that the people I've known who have been dealing with mental illness, most of them are not violent. But then when we have these incidents and we try to understand the underlying issues, certainly there are issues of illness, exclusion, isolation, and their inability to handle anger. And when it erupts, it's too late. Folks have suffered now immeasurable loss, and it's too hard to repair. It's better to be on the other side where you're intervening early and hoping to prevent these from ever happening.
How do you, though, figure out who among those that are exhibiting some of the characteristics that might in some way at some point ultimately lead someone to act out violently? How do you separate out the ones that really won't ever erupt from ones that may really genuinely be a threat to do so?
Well, the real trouble during treatment is that what the person discloses is what you act on. And even if there may be underlying issues of violence, if that doesn't even come close to the surface, you may be dealing with other issues in helping them get better, so to speak, and you never touch on it. That's one of the mysteries that we have to deal with, and we can't really just peel it away just because the person is presenting with a diagnosis. We're dealing with what they're wanting us to deal with, and not maybe below the surface that might be violence or issues like that.
Is there, though, language or signs or subtext or something that professionals can look for and listen for as they deal with someone who's availing themselves of mental health services that suggests this is a patient I should keep maybe even, you know, a closer eye on, or there may be something here where this person may be veering in the direction of someone who could down the road act out violently?
Well, typically their body language and their verbalizations are going to be clear enough to give you some sense, but then they're going to have to have a plan. They're going to be telling you how they feel and what they're going to do to react to these issues. Are there other people out there that they're focused on and who they're using as targets? At that point, we have a duty to report, and we've had occasion recently where we've had to identify local authorities and say, this person's a threat, and we want you to know about it.
Can you give me an example of how that sort of manifests itself?
Well, we had a person in Vermilion County who had been arrested for making threats, and in the course of talking with this individual, we knew that there were other threats involved. And so as we hospitalized the individual so that he could get treatment, we found out that we needed to warn another jurisdiction. And when we did that, they took it very seriously because that person was known to that community, and they then took action to deal with it.
Is it your belief that that's a common approach, or is it an exception to the rule that various jurisdictions are successfully working together to recognize that there may be someone out there that could be a violent threat?
Well, I think the fact that it happened right around Newtown really caused us, everyone, to be hyper-vigilant. And so I'm assuming that this is going to carry on for quite a while.
Is it possible to be too hyper-vigilant, that as a result, you sort of set your sights on someone that may be showing some signs, some indications of a potential, for violence, and it turns out that that's not the case at all, and maybe you've overshot the mark, you know what I mean?
Well, we have the issue of life as a special and sanctified element in our lives, and we want to protect it to the best we can, but then we have the person we're treating in front of us, and it's a very difficult line to not cross over and infringe upon their rights, but we also want to protect our community and our neighbors and our friends.
We're discussing the intersection between gun violence and mental health. Our guests, Tom Pollack, Executive Director of Crosspoint Human Services in Danville, Dorothy Espelage, Professor of Educational Psychology at the University of Illinois, and Mary Kay Mace, whose only daughter was killed in the shooting on the campus of Northern Illinois University 5 years ago this month. We welcome your questions and comments for our guests at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or post your questions or comments on Facebook or Twitter. We are on both sites at Focus 580. Those phone numbers again are 217-333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. I'll throw this out to all of you, and I'd like to start with Dorothy. Do we, by and large, in this country, take mental health as seriously as we should, or as seriously even as we take physical health?
No. I mean, our mental health has been, if you think about just the budgets that are allocated to mental health services, whether in schools and in our communities, it's just absolutely been slashed. And I even think about the reauthorization of No Child Left Behind. We're fighting to even keep counselors in our schools. And there's still, a stigma associated with mental health. And this is something that we need to address. A lot of folks, there's barriers to seeking intervention and seeking help because of the stigma associated with that.
Mary Kay Mace?
I definitely agree. There shouldn't be a stigma with people seeking help, for mental health problems. I do believe there's not enough attention given, and I do hope that most people know that just because a person's mentally ill, that doesn't necessarily follow that they're going to be violent, that most often they are not violent.
And Tom Pollack, when we talk about that stigma, earlier we were discussing people that avail themselves of mental health services or find themselves within the construct of mental health services. What about those folks that either for stigma or some other reasons, may be out there but are not connected to mental health services in any way?
Well, stigma certainly has been around for a long time, and people were shoved aside, and in terms of even the insurance coverage, you either couldn't get coverage or there was a lifetime limit, and there was no parity between health and mental health. That's since changed, but the stigma still lies around, and people have fears of things they don't understand or don't know, and it can affect your employment, your ability to advance in your job. So there's oftentimes good reason not to disclose and not to share with people that, in fact, you are a person being treated for mental illness. The thing is that with the proper treatment and drugs, the person could be sitting next to you in the pew in church or be another person in your grocery store. There's no outward signs that indicate a person is mentally ill.
You mentioned health insurance. Are we at a point now where most mental health services are covered by health insurance?
Most, correctly, yes, are covered, though there are oftentimes limits to the amount of therapy that's available, and they're cut off. And if, you know, if a person really hasn't gotten enough treatment, the symptoms will reoccur.
Would you like to see more coverage within health insurance, or is everything relatively adequate at this point?
Well, certainly you would want the coverage to continue long enough so that the person can say to others, I feel that I have recovered and that I am able to manage my affairs. If they don't feel that they have recovered, they're the ones best able to know.
What other ways can we make mental health services more accessible?
Well, we certainly have to get out to the community and let people know that services are available and that they should avail themselves of them. Clearly, marketing our services is really very important to the community.
We're discussing the intersection between gun violence and mental health with Tom Pollack, Executive Director of Crosspoint Human Services in Danville, Dorothy Espelage, Professor of Educational Psychology at the University of Illinois, and Mary Kay Mace, whose only daughter was killed in the shooting on the campus at Northern Illinois University 5 years ago this month. We'll take some calls and emails and have more discussion after a short break. This is Focus. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we are discussing the intersection between gun violence and mental health on today's program. My guests are Tom Pollack, Executive Director of Crosspoint Human Services in Danville, Dorothy Espelage, Professor of Educational Psychology at the University of Illinois, and Mary Kay Mace, whose only daughter was killed in the shooting on the campus at Northern Illinois University 5 years ago this month. We welcome your questions and comments for our guests at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or share your thoughts on Facebook or Twitter. You can find us on either one at Focus580. Those phone numbers again, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Let's move on to the notion of where mental health professionals and mental health services are needed today. Tom Pollack, in what institutions and in what circumstances?
Well, we have our community-based clinics, but clearly we should also be in schools. As was remarked earlier, children should have exposure to mental health issues, and so that they're aware of not only for their health, but for the health of their classmates.
And Dorothy Espelage, when we talk about these kinds of services in schools, and part of what we're talking about is whether or not there are professionals there, I gather, who can recognize whether or not someone is acting out aggressively or is a potential violent threat. Is that right?
Right. And, you know, we have social workers, school psychologists that are trained to identify mental health issues and actual diagnoses, but oftentimes they are spread across an entire school district or multiple schools. They may have thousands of kids that they are in charge of, and so their caseload, if you will, is full. And social workers will tell you that in central Illinois, that they simply cannot keep up. And the mental health issues that kids are bringing and the families of the kids have is just overwhelming, so there has to be this school-community connection. I also think we need to recognize that there are ways in which we can prevent the onset of some of these issues. If kids learn how to manage their anger, if kids learn how to be empathetic toward others, if kids learn problem-solving, you know, throughout their childhood and adolescence, then that is kind of bolstering preventing them in some ways from becoming aggressive. But we should recognize that 30% of the kids in this country indicate that they've been in a physical fight on school property in the last year. And so we need to think about how can we prevent aggression. In our recent study, we talking to kids for 15 weeks, giving them anger management skills, emotion regulation, how to listen, how to talk through problems, we reduced aggression by 42%. In those intervention schools. So we can do this. We need to think about how to fit it into the school day when testing is the priority, when social-emotional learning takes the back burner.
Let's take a call. We have Doug on the line from Spring Bay. Doug, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. A comment and then followed by a question. I will try to be brief, but it seems like the NRA's answer is more guns. And if that were the case, we should be a very safe place these days. To me, we are getting sidetracked into the conversation. I think this is, again, NRA approach. We want to talk about mental health. We want to talk about video games, violent TV programs, always to deflect back to the really the main issue, which is guns. You can have all the mental health problems you want, but if you introduce a gun into that situation, it suddenly becomes much more dangerous. Then, with the mental health, how do we pay for it? And so the question is, should we eventually start to, in order to allow these people to exercise their Second Amendment rights, should they pay through the taxation on their guns and their ammunition, or should the rest of the society be expected to pay for their enjoyment? I'll get off and listen off the line. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. Let me start with Tom Pollock. Any reaction to the concept of, well, maybe we tax the purchase of guns and use that funding to support mental health services?
That's a hard one, partly because my concern is the issues about gun ownership and the use of guns is over on this side of the fence. And on this side of the fence, I'd like to be able to think that mental health is something we all treasure and we all work for. He is correct that resources is an issue. That's one of the reasons why mental health services have been dismantled over time. The resources are not there. And I don't really have a good answer on how to pay for it because there's not enough enough resources to go around for everything.
Mary Kay Mace, any opinion on Doug's thoughts?
I agree with what Tom just said. I don't know that taxing gun owners and their ammunition at a higher rate would be as fair as asking the gun manufacturers to kick in some money, because they make a heck of a lot of profit from their industry. And maybe, I don't know what the legalities or anything like that would be, but my feeling is that you get a lot of pushback from taxing gun owners more. And, of course, the gun manufacturers wouldn't like it, but I think they would be more responsible for having responsibility to do that.
Dorothy Espelosh, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think Doug is right on in that there's these separate conversations that are happening in D.C., and the gun folks want to talk about guns. The video gamers proponents want to talk about video games, and then mental health advocates on the Hill are trying to get resources. What's lacking in the conversation is a comprehensive discussion around how do we become proactive in the society to reduce gun violence and to reduce violence in general. That comprehensive discussion is absolutely void because everyone's pushing their own agenda and concerned about their own individual rights. And what's happened is we're reactive. It took Sandy Hook for us to have this conversation, but the conversation is narrow. And until we understand that we have to be proactive and we have to think prevention and we have to think about, I go back to someone said earlier, when do we have a discussion about why it is that we have so many isolated and marginalized individuals in this country? You know, what is it about our society that tells certain people that they're, you know, not as good as someone else? I mean, that conversation is not happening.
Tom, when you hear those opposed to any restrictions on guns cite the need for better mental health services, do you take that seriously, or are you at all concerned they may just be paying lip service in the interest of shifting the debate, in the interest of deflecting, as Doug described it on the line, that as soon as they feel like their gun rights are protected, they'll stop sounding that call for better support for mental health services?
Well, I would like the message to continue that there needs to be more mental health services, and I don't particularly care from what source. So if folks on the gun lobby side would like to advocate for more mental health services, more power to them. One of the things that I want to make sure that is clear, and I think it's been brought up by Dorothy, and that is that violence is an issue that needs to be taken care of. Crosspoint works with people in the midst of domestic violence, and there may be very few who are threatened with guns, but there are a lot of other violent things that people do to one another that really should be worked on, both from an intervention and prevention standpoint.
And one way that some have turned to in terms of prevention is something known as the Mental Health First Aid Program. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the National Council for Community Behavioral Health has an evidence-based program called Mental Health First Aid, and it's aimed at the general community, though it's great for teachers so that they can bring it to their classroom. It's great for the police officer who otherwise wouldn't have that training. It's good for pastors so that they can see through their congregations persons that may have need for help. And very fortunately, here in Champaign, Community Elements is having a training March 21st and 22nd on Fox Drive. The cost is $90, but it would be well worth it to get this training, because then it gives you the ability to see people in the community in a different light, and hopefully you will be feeling more confident to intervene and hopefully prevent a serious problem to occur.
I guess, again, that's the sort of thing where you could see how that could work out very well or not so well.
Well, if somebody oversteps the A line, and I hope that through the training they will feel comfortable about that line, but it doesn't necessarily mean you have to personally intervene. You can make a referral. You can make a suggestion to the individual you're talking to. You don't have to feel like you're going to force the issue on them.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and there is still time for your questions and comments about mental health and gun violence at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Those phone numbers again, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Earlier, we talked about exposing kids to mental health conditions and trying to discourage stigma. Dorothy Espelage, how can we best go about educating children about mental health?
Right. So when we work with young kids, we work with them directly in developing skills to cope with stressors. But there's also what we need to recognize is that some of our kids are coming from homes and communities where they've experienced violence or trauma. And this is where we really need to increase our energy to figure out what we call, how can we implement what's called trauma-informed intervention so that we can place these kids, you know, to give them skills so that as they mature in age that they're able to deal with all of the challenges in life. So it has to be hit directly head-on. At the same time, there has to be a systemic approach to recognize that these kids come from families that the families themselves may need mental health services. So the discussion with the schools and the communities is also very, very important.
We have a comment from Susan. She writes, while our focus is on mass shootings because of the Newtown and other shootings, we should also consider one-on-one gun violence. This is far more prevalent. She also says, I'm deeply concerned about the paranoia the NRA is promoting. She says, it seems that law-abiding gun owners are being encouraged to think about needing to protect themselves. That means that a frightened person is encouraged to become judge, jury, and executioner rather than doing their best to be aware and avoid situations where they might become victims. And we already have too many men who think they must protect themselves from a partner who wants to leave. Tom, you're doing a lot of nodding.
Those comments are right on. Good points.
Yeah, I mean, she speaks to this notion that they're breeding fear in us. This fear culture is not going to help us address the issues that we have. That was beautifully put.
Mary Kay Mace, as you think back to 5 years ago, was there anything that Northern Illinois University, in your mind, could have done any differently? Is there anything that you look ahead and say, well, this is how university campus environments should operate, or did you feel like they did all they could in that kind of context?
I do feel they did all they could. Actually, our massacre happened just 10 months after the Virginia Tech tragedy, and NIU really learned the lessons from Virginia Tech, and the campus police were on site just practically right away. It was within 90 seconds. They didn't have to wait for a SWAT team to give the go-ahead to go on in. They were there. They went in, and as soon as the shooter saw the police closing in, he killed himself. So I don't think that NIU did anything wrong, and I do know that they have, in the aftermath, aside from renovating Cole Hall and making the classroom a much better space, meaning that kids will be able to escape should they need to, they have those narrow rows with those lap desks that, you know, kind of swing up on a swivel and across your lap. It was very hard for the kids to escape when the shooter entered the room and started firing his weapons. So that the new lecture hall they have in Cole Hall, it's very wide rows. It would be very easy for them to get out and escape more easily should the need arise. They also, I know, have beefed up their student counseling services. And so I do think that NIU is handling everything as optimally as they can.
Dorothy, is there anything more or more effective we could do to create a safer school environment on any campus, whether we're talking about college campus, high schools, middle schools, beyond?
Right. Yeah. And we talk quite a bit about school climate and positive school climate and what are the components of that. You know, we need to make sure that we are inclusive, that there's opportunities for everyone to connect in some level. And, you know, I have to say that I have been at the university for 16 years, and I have never seen a university that has so much and so many opportunities for kids, for the students to get connected, right? So I think that there's, you can find a home at the University of Illinois. What we need to do is to make sure that kids are connected as professors, as clinicians and practitioners, as just general folks that work at the university. Let's be vigilant about kids, students that look as if their behavior's changed or they're isolated and they're marginalized. I think generally we just need to be much more engaged with one another. And, you know, if something looks off, we should say something. Too many times we keep to ourselves and we don't want to get involved. And I think we need to recognize that this is a violence and climate issues is for all of us to own. And we want to be in a safe place, and that's we should do our part.
Tom Pollack, one thing that I feel like we've maybe danced around a little bit, or maybe, you know, have not focused a lot of attention on, at least this hour, is a question of, is there a role for the federal or state government in this in terms of providing funding for mental health services? Is that important, or is it a piece of the puzzle, or is it, you think it's not that big a deal?
Well, it's certainly a piece of the puzzle. Clearly, through Medicaid, they are funding mental health services. But President Obama did indicate that mental health first aid was a program that he certainly wanted to endorse. So there is an awareness, even at the highest levels, that intervening and trying to prevent these occurrences are really critical.
Let me ask all of you, and I'll ask you to try and be as specific as you can. At the end of the day, no matter what programs are in place, no matter what efforts are made, there could still certainly one of these days be another one of these mass shootings. And in fact, the awful reality of it is I think we all sort of assume at some point there will be another one somewhere. What can we change? What one thing might we be able to do that would be effective either in policy or funding or services available that could at least improve our ability to recognize and perhaps prevent a future mass shooting, though we may never know that we've done it?
Well, at Crosspoint, we've begun at a highest level of the administration to look at our practices within our buildings to keep not only staff but the people we serve safe. So we're looking at a variety of measures to institute. But then again, from the standpoint of treatment, we're limited by what we're told and what we see. And if we don't see the symptoms that would sort of preclude the notion of violence, there's little we can do.
Mary Kay Mace, is there anything you can think of that you believe would be effective to improve our ability to recognize and maybe prevent a future shooting?
I just would advocate for making sure all of the names, the records, get into the background check system. I know that the NIU gunman was worried that he wouldn't be able to obtain a gun illegally, which is why he acted when he did. There was a new law in Illinois in the aftermath of the Virginia Tech shooting that patients who are receiving counseling on an outpatient basis may, in some cases, be prohibited from purchasing a firearm. So he acted before that law took effect, and reportedly when he was visiting mental health services on the campus of U of I at the student services there, he reportedly wanted them to keep his visits off the record. So I do think it matters whether a gun is unavailable for somebody to easily get legally. They may not think that they have the wherewithal to get one illegally. So I would just want for all the records that are supposed to be in the database to make it in the database. You know, those who are adjudicated mentally ill, you would think would automatically just be sent right over, but those records aren't sent right over.
And Dorothy Espelage.
Yeah, I would argue that we desperately need to prioritize research in this area. I mean, we do not have the answers to many questions of who's at risk for this, what are the risk and protective factors. And then I'd also say that we need to put, you know, the human relationship back into children's lives in our schools and make sure that kids are developing those life skills so that we can prevent this from happening. But without, you know, true scholarship, we're in 2013. These kids live in a different world through social media, and we have no sense of what the social media has done as far as relationships, and so there has to be more research in this area.
Dorothy, speaking of kids, let's take a look at the college level. How can parents encourage students entering college, in college, to seek mental health if they need it?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to recognize that our college kids are adolescents, right? You're an adult, essentially. Your brain develops by the age of 25. So one, we need to recognize that, you know, parents still need to be actively involved with their college students, and many are. And, you know, when parents visit campuses, ask about these services. Ask about how the school addresses these issues when in crisis. And, you know, let's address the stigma. I mean, I think the stigma, as long as it's been here, we also have a really shifting demographics in which there's cultural barriers to some of the students on campus presenting. And they may have parents who would not necessarily encourage them to go seek mental health. So I think we need to reframe that and understand that all of us could use, you know, an improvement, if you will, a checkup around the ways in which we cope with situations in our lives.
Speaking of those checkups, Dorothy, I understand there's a symposium taking place next week in Urbana dealing with violence and bullying. And you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was actually yesterday.
It was yesterday. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was yesterday. And it was a very good conversation around, you know, hate and why it is that we have such negativity and how can we address this. And what was very clear, it was a community type of conference where the mayor was there from Champaign and we had Attorney General's office. It was very, very clear that everyone wants to be at the table to discuss this and that it's not just a school problem, it's not just a university problem, it's a community problem, and we need to come together. And that was the message yesterday.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank all of our guests for joining us today. Dorothy Espelage is a professor of educational psychology at the University of Illinois. Dorothy, thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Tom Pollack is executive director of Crosspoint Human Services in Danville, which provides mental health and recovery services, psychiatric care, youth crisis services, among other services for East Central Illinois. Tom, thank you very much.
It's a privilege. Thank you.
And Mary Kay Mace is the mother of Ryan Mace, one of the people killed 5 years ago this month at Northern Illinois University. Mary Kay Mace, thank you so much for joining us today as well.
Thank you. I've appreciated this discussion.
Pam Dempsey's coverage of mental health services on college campuses, our report earlier this hour, was funded by the Robert R. McCormick Foundation of Chicago. You can learn more about mental health issues on Midwest campuses at IJEC.org. And we welcome any additional thoughts that you may have about today's program on our website. That's will.illinois.edu/focus. If you know anyone who might enjoy hearing Focus but lives outside of our listening area, let them know we stream this program live every day at will.illinois.edu, where you can also listen back to past podcast programs. Focus is also available as a free downloadable podcast. To sign up, again, you can visit the Focus page of our website. That's will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's show, have you ever pet a cockroach? If you have been longing to, I don't know why you would, but if you have, you will get that chance this weekend during the Insect Fear Film Festival. We will talk with University of Illinois entomologist May Birnbaum about this year's festival. You may recall we had Chris Carter from the X-Files on yesterday. He will be participating in the Insect Fear Film Festival this weekend. We'll also talk about cockroaches. We will talk about flying insect swarms that may help to explain UFO sightings, and we'll, of course, welcome your questions about the insect world. Again, May Birnbaum joining us on tomorrow's Focus. Hope you can tune in then. Today's show is produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. I'm Craig Cohen.